Hello, and welcome to Star Wars Sleepover, a laid-back exploration of the captivating and sometimes ridiculous galaxy far, far away. I'm Europa Tokani, and as always, I'm here with my co-host.
Hi, I'm Loya Rowan, and at long last, we're talking about Rebels. We both finished the series, and we'll share our overall impression. And we're going to be focusing on Sabine Wren, Bo-Katan, Mandalore, and Honor. Let's do this.
Okay, it's time once again for Cantina Corner. Every episode, Loya and I are each choosing a Star Wars-themed drink to enjoy during our sleepover. And lately, we've kind of been alternating on and off with an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic option. And I think Loya's is non-alcoholic this week, is it?
I spiked it.
Okay. Just kidding. We will have non-alcoholic options going forward occasionally, but not this week. So I actually planned to make a different drink, and then I tried this one that I made for today because my household had a Disney day, a Disney Parks day at home yesterday because, as we've established, we're Disney adults and we own it. So we made a Galaxy's Edge copycat recipe, and it is the Jedi Mind Trick. So it's a drink that's served at Oga's Cantina in Star Wars Galaxy's Edge at Walt Disney World. I have not tried this at Disney World, so again, I can't really testify to the accuracy, but it seems like it's pretty close from what I know of the drink, and it is delicious. So I decided to make it again today. And the ingredients are Kettle One Botanicals Grapefruit and Rose Vodka, which I am a fan of anyway. It's really good. It's like awesome, even if you just mix it with soda water. It's like a nice, refreshing drink. So definitely recommend that. And then an ounce of Welch's White Grape Juice. They like specifically suggested Welch's white grape juice. Not sure why, but that's what we got. And then Falernum Blue Curacao, which I will just have for the next year from that one time I made a drink with Blue Curacao over the summer for this podcast. Freshly squeezed lime juice and a dash of grapefruit bitters.
Ooh, nice. I've been wanting grapefruit bitters. Like, where did you get them?
Amazon. Sorry.
Amazon. Got it. Cool.
Yeah, you can get pretty much anything on Amazon. If you like grapefruit, I can definitely recommend this drink. If you really hate grapefruit, I probably would not recommend it because it does have several grapefruit components. But I think everything just balances out well. And I also found out that I really like Falernum, which I probably have had in drinks before, but probably like didn't necessarily know. It's something that's used in a lot of, like, tropical drinks, and I also used it yesterday in a second drink that we had, which was, like, just kind of spur of the moment, because we had made Pog juice, which is orange. The O is orange, so I should say passion fruit, orange, and guava juice, which is something that's served at Disney World, but it's, like, a Hawaiian thing, and we basically just spiked that with light rum and dark rum, and then I put a little bit of Falernum in it, and it was like perfect. So I would also recommend trying that.
I'm totally adding all of these things to my drinks list going forward. It sounds incredible. All right, so for me, I made an easy Star Wars R2-D2 milkshake from the website Darcy and Brian. And it's funny because I came across this recipe after our episode about Droid Tales. And in this post, they are specifically talking about Droid Tales. So it was very like, oh, missed that. But it ended up working out because I had to hunt down Blue Moon ice cream. So the ingredients are Blue Moon ice cream, a cup of milk, Ready Whip, and then Sprinkles. Does say that if Blue Moon ice cream is not available in your area, and I'm sorry for you if that is the case, you can experiment with blue food coloring and almond extract. I don't know about that. I feel like Blue Moon ice cream is so good and so unique that blue food coloring and almond extract are not going to accurately capture its taste. So, yes, maybe just skip it if you can't get Blue Moon ice cream. So, yes, and then I did add a little bit of vodka. This recipe did not call for the vodka, so you can make it non-alcoholic if you like. I didn't throw that much in there, but it is, let me taste it. Delicious. Oh my gosh, Blue Moon. So good. So good.
I don't think I mentioned, which I totally meant to, the recipe that I used for the Jedi mind trick is from Disneyfy, which is a great resource if you're like us and you want to recreate the Disney parks at home, especially if you want to make like Disney recipes, whether it's food or cocktails. And their slogan is make every day a park day, which is exactly what we were trying to do. So we actually used that website for a couple of different recipes. So definitely check them out if you are a Disney adult like me.
And now time for the Mouse Droid segment.
So this is the part of our episode where we kind of talk about random news as it pertains to like basically just the two of us and what we've been doing that's related to Star Wars. So the first thing that I wanted to share is very exciting for us. I have talked about previously on this podcast the Into a Larger World zine and the fact that I'm a subscriber. I love getting it every month. It's always awesome. And Kara, who is the person behind the zine, makes a lot of awesome collage art like within the zine and then also does prints. And you should definitely check her out at Into a Larger World by Kara on Instagram if you haven't already. She actually did a whole issue on podcasts, Star Wars podcasts, for the month of March. I had reached out to her about something else, but she had told me that she was planning this issue and asked if we would want to be involved. And I was like, yes, absolutely. I would be honored to be involved. And I think she just started sending out the March issue last week and we get a little shout out. So I just want to thank Kara once again for including us because we are a new podcast. So it's super exciting to be in the company of all the other podcasts that are in that issue, which are some of our favorites. So just really awesome issue overall and glad to be a part of it.
And then the other thing that we've been doing in the larger Star Wars world is I started Battlefront 2 yesterday. That game is difficult. So I've been playing with my husband and it is kind of that same feeling like when you first start Mass Effect multiplayer, where like it takes a while to get used to things. And then it's also very disheartening sometimes to be the fourth, like they rank you at the end of each match. And I'm consistently the fourth because I just die. It's hard. And possibly it is just me, but yes, I feel like I can shoot droids all day long and like eventually they will die, but like two shots from a droid and I'm just dead and then I have to respawn. But it's been interesting. I've been enjoying it. I'm possibly a little too excited to play as heroes. So I've been playing as Chewie and it is fantastic. I'm just like running around and then like they have the ability to like change appearances. So I have Chewie with like goggles, which look like sunglasses and kind of remind me of Joe Biden, of course, because that's how I roll. And yeah.
I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast. I think maybe it's calmed down.
Yes.
Over the past like month and a half, 2 months, but there was a period where Loya was having very frequent dreams involving Joe Biden.
So the one this week was I was touring the White House and Joe was talking about the two, like traditionally when you tour the White House, this is not true by any means, But in the dream, traditionally, you were shown My Fair Lady, which is not one of my favorite movies in any way, shape, or form. But he wanted to, like,
watch that together then.
I think because I wanted to see it in its entirety.
Okay.
And, like, the music, I grew up listening to the music, so I have a little bit of a soft spot for that. But I personally feel like Pygmalion with Leslie Howard is 10 times better, in part because Leslie Howard is, like, very attractive in that to me. Yeah, so he was trying to, like, switch out the films, and I said, no, 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 you can't possibly do that. And then he's like, well, do you want to watch My Fair Lady then? I'm like, no, I don't want to watch My Fair Lady.
I have not played Battlefront 2 in a long time. I was confused when talking to you, Loya, over text about it, because I didn't even realize that there was a Battlefront 1 remake and then Battlefront 2. Like, I thought they were the same game, and I don't know why. I do have both of them, which I had to confirm, and I have played one. As you said, at one point when you visited, we did play it together. And then I got Battlefront 2, and I played the campaign, which actually was really good, but then I just stopped playing it because I do not want to play online with anyone, and I don't think you can play co-op locally, so,
yeah. So, there are co-op missions, but then you are joined by two other people who are... Darth Brooks was doing much better than me. I felt like I was bringing the team down. But it was interesting because, like, we definitely were already specializing in different things. So, like, it allows you to pick your class, kind of like Battlefield, apparently. And he was gravitating towards the officer assault classes, of course. And I was going for the specialist heavy, which is also kind of my MO. I like sniping, as we've talked about, I feel like.
Honestly, I'm sure you're not as bad as my sister, Siri, who was on this podcast as a guest and will be coming back this season, which we're excited for. But she was playing it one time when she was over, like, when I had first gotten Battlefront 1, and she wanted to play as Palpatine.
Yeah!
And she just, like, she's not used to playing video games. Like, I'm better than she is, although I'm not good at video games, but, like, she just isn't used to the mechanics. So she could barely even walk him around. And then she was, like, basically trying to walk him up walls and just, like, randomly, like, shooting out force lightning.
I feel like we played as Palpatine as well. And that was a lot of fun because, like, he was just crazy. Yeah, I spent a lot of time yesterday manipulating the appearance and, like, the emotes and all the, like, customability of that game. So, like, I was, like, picking the appropriate Palpatine, like, poses. Yeah, it was good fun. I actually have
not played it at all since they've done, I think, most updates. So, mm-hmm. I think I tried to play it once as Rey when they first added Rey. But yeah, that's it. Like, I have not played as any other characters outside of the original trilogy.
It is. I feel like it is more difficult than Mass Effect. Because I feel like Mass Effect, like, you just, like, by virtue of going into matches, you can then purchase different things. But, like, it feels like there's more of a... I don't know how to describe it. So, like, you have to, like, accrue battle points during the missions. And so, like, in order to become Rey, you have to have 4,000. So I kept dying and then respawning and then, like, saving up my battle points. And then the match ended. So I never became Rey because, like, it was over and I didn't have enough. Again, this is probably because I'm also not the greatest. So, yeah.
I'm also having flashbacks to the campaign where... there's, like, Kylo Ren is there in the end, and he's just so annoying. Like, you're trying to fight, and he, like, I forget exactly what his phrases were, but I was just like, oh my god, just shut up. Like, I can't take it.
But when the Empire shows up, it is pretty funny, where it's just like, Darth Maul! It's just like, Count Dooku, General Grievous, oh my god. And it is very satisfying to shoot them down, I'm not gonna lie. Especially Maul, every time. Except he just kills me, so I guess I'm not really spending a whole ton of time shooting him down.
Okay, well, let's move on to Rebels, and let's just talk about our overall reaction to Rebels and what we thought of it, because we both finished the whole series, and I think we both really liked it, but I am wondering what you liked about it in particular, and then we'll get into some more aspects of it.
Yeah. So there are a lot of different things that I really enjoyed about it, but I'm going to choose my time now to talk about Melch, who is an Ugnaught.
When you said that, I was like, I have no idea who that is. So I'm interested to hear more.
Oh, we should clarify. This entire episode is going to have a lot of spoilers for Rebels. So if you haven't seen the last final season of Rebels, you should stop listening.
I mean, I would say like that's unlikely, but given that we just watched Rebels, it's totally possible. So if you have not watched all of Rebels, then probably just stop listening now, because we're going to get into a lot of important things that happened in the last season.
So Melch. Okay, so I just finished watching this past week, and I actually watched the last episode on the day that we were originally going to record this. And people die. So Kanan dies in the series, and Gregor dies. And then there's a scene where Melch the Ugnaught is rushing in. Like, it's a very tense, like, it's the final episode, the finale, and he is an associate of Hondo, who of course comes back for this final shebang, and Hondo kind of has a redemption arc there. But Melch the Ugnaught runs towards these enemies and like under heavy fire, and he's shot. And like that was the moment that like had the biggest emotional impact on me for some reason.
Wow.
I know. I was downstairs and I was just like, no, like middle of the day, because I was watching over my lunch break.
I can't say the same. I will say I had the most emotional impact on me, and it was definitely probably more in line with the moment that was the most impactful for most people.
I know. I think it was just the fact that I suddenly realized that everyone, I mean, going back always to Rogue One season, like, it was the moment where I realized people were going to die. More people were going to die, because I guess I always assumed that Kanan was going to die for some reason. I don't know why. And Melch goes down, and then Gregor's shot, and I'm just like, oh my gosh. And I thought Zeb was going to die. And that was it for me. And I was not okay with it. And then it turns out Melch didn't die. And there's also, I was looking this up, there's Melch has a fan base, so I'm not entirely alone in this, my love for Melch. And then the other part that I really wanted to talk about was I was not super thrilled about the I can never say that word. Posthumous. The posthumous birth of Kanan and Hera's son.
Okay, I am just extremely confused
about the
timeline of their relationship.
It makes no sense. So I spent most of the series assuming that they were in a relationship.
Right? Like, literally from, like, the first season, I was like, okay, yes. Like, they're clearly together. Yes. The way that they interact, like, they're together. And I feel like I knew that already. Yeah. And I was like, okay. And then, like, all of a sudden, towards the end of the series, they're like, how do you feel about me? I'm not sure. And I'm just like, what is happening?
Yeah. Exactly. I had the exact same reaction, and I was just kind of a little bit baffled. Like, I'm like, okay, so I guess Disney recognizes that its audience is going to be children, and there's not much interest in like this romance. So, cause they didn't kiss. Like, I assumed they were in a relationship because of how they interacted, but there was no kissing.
Yeah.
It was all very chaste. And then in the final season, there's this weird, like, tension between them, and they keep like getting interrupted as they're about to kiss. So then all of a sudden it's just like, wait, was I just wrong this entire time? And they were in a relationship,
because then that implies that they've never kissed before.
Yeah,
which I guess isn't necessarily the case, but that's what it was making it seem like, and that just didn't make any sense to me. And I was just like, okay, like, so then in my head I had to be like, all right, so like, clearly there was something going on between them. Like, now I, as an adult, have to assume that, like, they, like, hooked up.
I guess?
A bunch of times, but, like, didn't have a talk where they were like, I like you and I would like to be in a relationship. Like, yeah. And then that's what came later. So that's just like what I have to go with, I guess.
But it also just doesn't make any sense. Like, neither of them have like anything. Like, they could have easily just had a conversation. Like, there was nothing blocking that conversation from happening. And like, except for in the final season where like every single time they tried, they were interrupted. But there's this scene where like they're talking and Chopper's there and Chopper's just making this noise like, meh, 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 meh. Like, he's just making fun of them. And I'm just like, yeah, Chopper, I don't get it either. Like, this doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, because I just thought of them as a couple.
Yeah.
From the beginning of the series.
Yep.
So I just don't get it. And I really like them.
And then this kid shows up.
Like, yeah. I love them together as a couple. Yeah. But it was just bizarre to all of a sudden be like, wait, they're not?
Yeah. And then later on, apparently, yes, they were.
And like, between the time that they kissed, that they finally kissed, like, on camera, and then Kanan died, like, not very many episodes later.
Yeah. Exactly. So I don't understand it. I don't understand it. That was probably, yeah, like, a dislike for me, is like, I feel like they could have just handled that so much better. Because, as you said, I do like them as a couple. Like, they're fantastic. I like both characters a lot. And they're good together.
Yeah. And then their child just looks bizarre.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is, like, intentional. Like, yeah, yes, I know their child is half Twi'lek and half human. But, like, I don't think that's why. I think it's just,
I don't think so either,
the way that he was designed and or animated.
Yep. Exactly. Also, unrelated, but by the end of the season, I was like, Callus is kind of hot.
Yes! Oh my god, I'm so glad you agree.
And I really like his voice. And then also he started Callus getting this like stubble between his like weird stuff. And I was like, okay.
I like started feeling that way and I was just like, is there something wrong with me?
Well, and especially considering, like, I had the whole thing with Cad Bane. I'm just like, I feel like your love of cartoon animated characters is getting a little disturbing. But at the same time, like, of the two, Callus is obviously the more normal choice. So, yeah. But by the end, I was like, yes, yes, I would move to the Lasat hidden planet with you. Like,
yes. I love him. Like, I feel like it's a similar situation to Norrington and Pirates of the Caribbean.
Or like, yes.
You're not supposed to like him, but then he just like goes through all this stuff and like just becomes scruffy, and then you're just like, oh, hey.
Yeah, exactly. It's the scruffiness, like when he's uptight and like, obviously in Callus's case, Imperial, that was not okay. But that episode with Zeb was also really, yeah, like, that was like, oh.
And then they, like, have this enduring friendship. And
yeah. Yes. Yes. I really liked his development as a character.
I was going to bring that up if you didn't. So I'm just, like, delighted that you agree.
Those are my, like, immediate, like, things I definitely want to discuss. Melch being a hero. What on earth was going on between Hera and Kanan? What's with the kid? And then Callus being very easy on the eyes. Oh, and I was very... one more thing. I have to talk about the Mikkelsens again, because, as we all know, Mads Mikkelsen is amazing. Mads! Lars Mikkelsen, his brother, plays Thrawn's voice actor. He continues to be deeply terrifying to me. I first saw him in Sherlock, and he was a very disturbing villain in that, and it just continues. Like, Thrawn's, like, intonation, it's just, like, his voice gives me the heebie-jeebies. I'm sure he's a perfectly lovely person, but I'm scared of him.
I almost get kind of, like, a Hannibal Lecter vibe from
him. Yeah. Which, again, going back to the Mikkelsens, Mads Mikkelsen did play Hannibal Lecter.
It's all connected.
It's all connected. Yeah, and that's, I'm also not that interested in Hannibal at all. It's like the cerebral villains. I like my villains to be competent, but I also like them to have a temper and like,
right, and
yeah
like that type of villain is very cold and calculating.
Yeah.
So in terms of what I really like about Rebels, I would say, first of all, the characters. Mm-hmm. I think Rebels has fantastic central characters, and it's really hard to say who's my favorite because I think they all work as a unit. Mm-hmm. And like they really are a family, and it's really about them kind of going on this journey together. And I like pretty much all of them, which I feel like is unusual, except for Chopper.
Yeah.
And
well, and you know I feel about Chopper.
Yeah. I will say, I think if I had to choose a favorite, it would be Hera. And I would love to see more of her in other things. I just found out she's in the Alphabet Squadron novels, which I wouldn't necessarily be interested in on their own, but I might have to check them out now because they involve Hera. And
I would do that too.
Yeah, I think she's going to become like one of my favorites. And another thing that I really liked about it was how weird it gets with all of the Force stuff.
Yeah.
Especially in the fourth season. Like, I don't know where these things are coming from other than from the mind of Dave Filoni. But it's just
who plays
like,
Chopper, incidentally.
Yeah. It's just like, sure, like there are giant Force wolves now. Great.
Yes. I'd love
to go to the World Between Worlds, and Ezra is just going to pull Ahsoka into the World Between Worlds and stop her from being killed. Like, great. Like, also, the design of all of that is really interesting to me.
Yeah.
And maybe I just need to, like, you know what? I do need to get the Rebels, the Art of Rebels art book, because I love the art of books, and now that I've finished Rebels, I definitely need that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I hope that we get to see more of those things. Oh, and I also forgot the whales. I forget what they're called now, but I also love them.
Yeah. I was not thrilled that they didn't tear Thrawn apart, although I assume Thrawn's going to be alive after the end of this. So I guess I was never going to see the, like, satisfying destruction of this villain.
But yeah, honestly, in Star Wars, like, the weirder the better. Like, just throw the weirdest, most bizarre things that you possibly can at me, and like, I will love it. So I was excited for that. I do hope we find out what happens to Ezra.
Mm-hmm.
And I am totally on board for whatever they want to do with those concepts that were introduced in Rebels.
Yes. Yep. I feel like it was really great world building, which we've talked about. And it added a lot. Also, the voice acting, I'm always astonished that they're able to, I don't know why, who doesn't want to be involved in Star Wars? But every time I'm like, oh, wow, that was Forrest Whitaker. James Earl Jones did reprise his role as Darth Vader for this. Like, I don't, again, know why I'm consistently surprised. But in addition, Warwick Davis was Rook, the assassin guy. Jim Cummings was Hondo again. I was convinced he was also Visago, but he's not. And then the other one I wanted to highlight, I'll skip the one that we're going to talk about later, but Gina Torres was Ketsu Onyo. And then James Hong was as Morgan, who I love. Billy Dee Williams was Lando again. And then Ray Stevenson was Gar Saxon. I just wanted to point that out because you know how I feel about Ray Stevenson as well. The man's amazing. And then Malcolm McDowell was Minister Hayden, the art guy, which like immediately recognized his voice.
You are so much better at recognizing voices than I was. And
yeah. I did have IMDb up. Oh, and Jennifer Hale, who plays Commander Shepard's voice, she had a small role as well.
Nice. So I had on here two dislikes. I don't know if I had that many dislikes. I dislike how emotionally devastated I was by Kanan dying.
Oh, that was the emotional part you were talking about.
So I was, for some reason, unprepared for that. Like, I actually knew that he died. I knew going to happen. Yeah. So I knew it was going to happen at some point. But for whatever reason, I didn't expect it to happen in that episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so it's the episode where Hera gets captured by the Empire. Mm-hmm. And Kanan goes to save her, and he does save her. And they were, like, having all of these, like, amazing couple moments. And I was like, this is great. But for whatever reason, I assumed that they were going to get to be together for some amount of time. And then Kanan was going to die, like, more towards the end of the season. Mm-hmm. But that was not the case. Like, he rescued her. They had, like, a nice little conversation. And then he died, basically, to allow her to escape, like, mm-hmm. 5 minutes later. And it was so devastating. Like, I was much more upset than I thought I would be. Like, it was just awful.
Yeah. For some reason, I think once he cut his hair, I just assumed he was going to die. Like, he was making all those references, too, where he was, like, talking to Ezra, and I'm like, yep, he's going to die. And then he cut his hair, and then he was talking to Hera, and I'm like, he's going to die. So I was not, which is odd, because I didn't actually know he was going to die before watching the season, I guess.
I also felt like he was probably going to die soon after he cut his hair, but then he didn't die immediately, so I mm-hmm. feel like I just was lulled into a false sense of security, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, because he cuts his hair, he, like, saves her, and then they're, like, about to escape, and that's when he dies. So that makes sense.
And then yeah. I just kept thinking about it, too. I'm like, so Hera must be pregnant.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I felt like I was analyzing everything. I was just like, she's touching your stomach. They're alluding to her being pregnant. I don't know if that was intentional or not, or maybe just reading into it. I was actually surprisingly, like, I really liked Kanan. I don't know what it was. Maybe I'll, like, it'll hit me later and I'll be like, no. Yeah. I was somehow not emotionally involved, triggered. What's the word I'm looking for?
Affected.
Yes, thank you. Emotionally affected by his death, which I feel like this podcast just makes me seem like some sort of emotionally stunted. I don't know. I feel like did I mention that with Melch? Is like, it's the same sort of thing with Dobby. Like, I hated Dobby as a character, and then Dobby dies, and that was like the death that got me. Like, I did feel very sad when Dumbledore died, and, like, I was affected as well with the twins and everything, but, like, Dobby's death, for whatever reason, I hated him, and I was just like,
I might be the opposite of you, because over the past few weeks, we've watched a bunch of, like, Disney and Pixar movies that I haven't seen, so last week or a couple of weeks ago, we watched Inside Out.
Oh, I love that movie.
And I liked it, but my sister kept being like, I don't know if you want to watch that. You need to, like, be emotionally in the right space to watch it. Like, you might cry or be upset. And I was like, okay, but, like, you know me. Do you think I will cry? And she was like, I don't know. It all depends on how you feel about it. And I was like, okay.
So Wait, did you cry?
Do you know what I'm talking about? Spoilers if you haven't seen Inside Out. Don't listen to, like, the next 3 minutes. Also, if you haven't seen Frozen 2, I would say skip ahead maybe, like, 5 minutes.
I mean, I've seen Inside Out. I cried. I cry every time.
Okay, I did not cry Inside Out. And the specific part that my sister was referencing was when Bing Bong sacrificed.
Yes. Oh my God. I cried then. But the hardest tears are when, like, she is talking to her parents at the end and she's like, you know, everything's all messed up and her, like, yeah, man, there's so many tears during that movie. But yes, I also cried with Bing Bong's death.
I thought Bing Bong was super annoying and did not shed a tear when he sacrificed himself. And my sister was crying. Like, she had already seen it, and she was crying.
Yeah,
and
no,
she was
like, he sacrificed
himself. And I'm just like, yeah, the good riddance to Bing Bong.
This is making me feel better, though. I hope you know that. Because, like, like, in the course of this podcast, I've already said, like, Grogu leaving Jyn didn't affect me. Talked disturbingly about Cad Bane. Just talked about Melch versus Kanan. Like, I feel like these are outliers. And I was starting to feel a little bit like an outlier myself. I'm feeling better.
And then I don't want to give you spoilers for Frozen 2. Do you know anything about Frozen 2?
I don't. I told you that I wasn't a huge fan of Frozen.
Your feelings on Olaf?
I hate Olaf.
Okay, good. So.
Oh my god, this means I'm going to cry when he dies, isn't it?
Well, I had been told by my sister that Olaf dies in Frozen 2, and I was just like, don't care. And then we watched it, and yes, like, he does die, I guess. But then he comes back, and I was like, damn it.
Yeah, I hate Olaf. But now I know I'm going to cry, so I'm going to be sure to have tissues. Pretty much, like, if I... if I don't really care about you or slightly dislike you, I'm going to be shed tears at your death. Beloved character that I adore. Sorry.
Olaf could have just stayed gone. I can't deal with Olaf. All right, anyway, now that we're completely off topic talking about Frozen, was there anything that you particularly disliked about Rebels?
I forgot to mention Jason Isaacs, too, as the Grand Inquisitor for voice acting.
Oh, right, I completely forgot about
him. Yeah, I was like, how did they convince him to do this? But I appreciate
Jason Isaacs is amazing. I love Jason Isaacs.
Oh, my God. I was talking to my coworker, and she was talking about Star Trek, the new one, because he's in it. And she's like, I think I like Jason Isaacs now. I'm like, now? You did before.
Where have you been for the past 20 years?
Well, I was like, I guess technically all the characters I like Jason Isaacs in, he's evil. So if you have a solid moral compass, possibly you won't like
Jason. You know what is, in my opinion, Jason Isaacs' best role?
I'm listening.
Captain Hook.
Oh my god, yes. Yes.
I love that version of Peter Pan just overall, but yeah. Oh my god.
Yeah, Jason Isaacs' Captain Hook is just, be still my heart. Oh, I also love him as Malfoy. Not gonna lie.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I'm not really into him as Malfoy.
He's a little craven, a little cowardly. But when he threatens Harry, I was there for that wand in his cane. Yeah.
My husband and I also really enjoyed the OA on Netflix, which is like
I have not seen that
weird show, and I can understand why people would hate it, which I think a lot of people did, and then it got canceled. But Jason Isaacs is in that as well, and
what?
I'm sad for him that he doesn't get to make another season.
Oh man, I'm gonna have to watch that now. My sister recommended it, and
I have to be 100% honest. I'm gonna watch it and be like, what is
this? Yeah, that's possible. Let's see. Hang on. Anything that I was gonna say about disliking in Rebels? Oh, Tom Baker as Bendu. Also loved that, as we've talked about. And then, yeah, nothing really comes to mind.
Well, yeah. So I didn't think we should attempt to discuss all of Rebels in one podcast episode, so I'm sure we will go back to Rebels in the future and talk about other things, but for this one, I decided to discuss a couple of episodes from season 3 and then the first 2 episodes of season 4, and I wanted to focus on kind of Sabine's personal journey as a Mandalorian and how she fits into kind of the wider world of the rebellion and what's going on, and then also how she relates to Bo-Katan. So I thought that was really interesting, and I really enjoyed what these episodes did with Sabine's character.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought that you would just like to discuss them, Loya, because it's a lot of Mandalorians.
It is. It is.
So we are going to be discussing, starting with season 3, episode 16, Trials of the Darksaber. And then we will briefly touch on season 3, episode 16, Legacy of Mandalore. And then what is actually a two-part arc, I guess, episode, season 4, episode 1 and 2, which is Heroes of Mandalore. So before we get into the action, I wanted to just talk a little bit about the characters that appear in this set of episodes. I will say for myself, Sabine was not necessarily like an immediate favorite for me. Mm-hmm. I understood her character, but I didn't necessarily relate to her because, as I've kind of alluded to on this podcast, like, if there's anyone that I'm going to relate to, it would be teenage Leia, who was like a very, I don't want to say boring, but like definitely was not. I mean, she was getting into trouble, but not like Sabine was. Like, I was certainly not out like graffitiing things or like flouting the rules and like dyeing my hair wild colors. So she's not someone that I would immediately look at and be like, yes, I totally get you. But I think over the course of the series, they just developed her character so well that I became much more interested in her journey and kind of how she was growing. So I really appreciated this set of episodes as they related to her.
That's so interesting. Because I also was not, I've never graffitied anything or dyed my hair a wild color, but I liked Sabine from the start. And we all know what it is. It's the competence, right? She blows things up. She's very good at what she does. She like knows how to repair things, which is not something I don't know how to do either. She's like on point with her target. She attended the Imperial Academy and she has all these mad skills. Yeah, I liked her reactions to things. Her reactions to the situations frequently made sense to me, and I wish that I had like her poise and her can-do attitude and abilities so that I too could react in a similar way. So that's kind of how, yeah, Sabine was solid for me.
I would say she's very confident and she comes off as very sure of herself. Mm-hmm. Even though, I guess as we'll find out later, she isn't always.
Yes. Yes. There's definitely some baggage there that, in as we'll discuss, she takes care to not make obvious.
So in relation to that, we'll talk a little bit about her family who are introduced in the season 13 episodes. And so I think there has been mention of her mom, at least in previous episodes, but we had never met her. Mm-hmm. So she is from Clan Ren and her mom is Ursa Ren. And she is the head of their clan. And she is basically the warrior of the family. And then when Sabine's dad, Alrich Ren, is introduced, he's the one that is the artist, and that's where Sabine kind of inherited her artistic ability and her creativity from.
Oh, and but he takes pains to clarify that the creativity comes from her mom because Ursa is very creative in how to kill people.
So yeah, they have an interesting dynamic for sure. Yes. And although he is the artist, he also is very critical of Sabine, apparently, because literally about 2 seconds after they reunite, they're talking about Sabine's art, and he says that he's seen some of it, and he tells her that she's better than she used to be, and starts talking about how her previous work was derivative of all these other artists.
And she goes, obviously, but I've made it my own. Also, he's introduced, like, the first time we meet him, he's being threatened by the Saxon clan, essentially. And they're taking him to the capital, and he's just like, oh, I love the capital. The architecture there is so splendid. And I'm just, man, again, just would love to be that unfazed in light of possible execution.
Yeah, I mean, so maybe that's a Mandalorian trait that just is present in him despite everything else.
Also, I mean, we'll talk about this because I think we're going to get into, like, the plot. But Ursa was, like, willing to kill Sabine there for a second.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no guarantee Sabine could have survived. And she did anyways. So.
So then Sabine also has a brother, Tristan, who has come to serve Clan Saxon, basically, to help their own clan survive. And he probably is the most actually loyal to his own family and to Sabine. And that will come to bear in the plot.
He also, I like the fact, I think he's in later episodes and he has this kind of dynamic with Ezra that I appreciated. I might be making that up. There are two people that I get moderately confused. They're both young, dark hair.
Through the course of these episodes, we find out what happened to Sabine on Mandalore and why she left and why she won't go back, although she does eventually. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that all was really compelling, and I thought these episodes were great, and again, just like really fleshed out Sabine's character and had a lot of weight for her.
Yeah.
So then we also get the reintroduction of Bo-Katan in the beginning of season 4 and learn more about her own relationship with Mandalore after we see her in the Clone Wars. So just to recap, in the Clone Wars, she was a lieutenant in Death Watch, and she was opposing her sister, Satine, who was the ruler of Mandalore at the time, and she plotted with Maul and Savage to overthrow Satine's government. And then Maul eventually challenged and defeated Pre Vizsla, who was the leader of Death Watch, and he became the ruler of Mandalore with Prime Minister Almec as a puppet leader. And then at that point, Bo-Katan decided to work to liberate Satine from prison. However, Satine was then killed by Maul in front of Obi-Wan after Obi-Wan was called to Mandalore. Bo-Katan asked that the Republic be notified so that they would come and hopefully kill Maul. Then Bo-Katan became the regent of Mandalore, but she was driven out after she refused to obey Palpatine when the Empire came to power. So that's a lot. She was doing a lot. She changed sides. And I am not totally sure what she's been doing in the interim since she was driven out of Mandalore and the events of these episodes.
Yeah. Because she appears and she said that she was instructed by Ursa Wren to assist. And so presumably she's still working with her clan, but that's not clear. I agree.
And then we have the other Mandalorians that play a part in all of this. So we have Fenn Rau, who originally appeared in Rebels as an Imperial lookout to keep Rebels away from the Concord Dawn system, but then he turns on the Empire when he learns that Gar Saxon, who is like the Imperial governor on Mandalore, has actually killed his Mandalorian comrades. And then I just have to point out that apparently the voice actor for Fenn Rau is Kevin McKidd, and I had like no idea.
I knew it
a few episodes in.
So I, in all fairness, I knew that because I had looked up IMDb to check out Visago. I was like, oh, Kevin McKidd's in this. I could not remember the last time I saw Kevin McKidd in anything. So I was like very excited about this. And yeah.
Oh, the last time I saw Kevin McKidd in anything was like every day, because my husband and I have been watching Grey's Anatomy from season 1 for what I've confirmed has now been a year, because I was looking back at my photos on my phone from last March, and there was a picture that I took that had the TV in the background and Grey's Anatomy was on, and we are still not caught up.
Oh my gosh, there's no way. There's
Kevin
no way.
Kevin McKidd is like a major character in Grey's Anatomy who I hate.
Yeah.
I hate him. Owen Hunt, I'm sorry if you like that character, but I despise him. And it's very strange for me, because the first thing that I saw Kevin McKidd in was Rome, the HBO series, which is actually, like, one of the first things that my husband and I ever watched together. So we have, like, a strange nostalgic connection to Rome, and also I just love that series. And, like, I liked him in that. I have no problem with Kevin McKidd as an actor or a person, but I hate Owen Hunt. So I was glad to have him in this role with his, like, natural accent, not an American accent, and just, like, hear the Kevin McKidd that I want to experience.
This is so interesting. I haven't actually seen Kevin McKidd in much. I've seen him in, I've seen Trainspotting. I feel like I saw him in a romantic comedy, and I think I just made this up. Because, like, I'm not seeing anything on his filmography that would be in that category. Kingdom of Heaven, he's English Sergeant. Maybe the Virgin Queen. You and I watched that. And then Rome. Yeah. Oh, maybe it's Maid of Honor.
Oh, maybe.
Oh, yep. Here we go. Here we go. This is the romantic comedy I'm thinking of. Ha ha ha. Success. Yes. Also, a thing about Fen Rau is the only reason he agreed to cooperate initially, even before he, like, truly committed, was because the ghost took him as prisoner. And he was just being very intractable. And then, yes, he eventually converted for real because Gar Saxon killed his men.
So this, speaking of Gar Saxon, so Gar Saxon was, like Bo-Katan, a member of Death Watch under Pre Vizsla, and he formerly commanded Maul's forces on Mandalore. He executed Prime Minister Olmec, and he is now one of Palpatine's Emperor's Hands.
Wait, did they cover that in episodes, or was this background information?
I'm honestly not sure.
Okay, because I feel like this information about Prime Minister Olmec being dead is brand new to me. Granted, it's possible I just missed it during one of the episodes, but that's surprising. Not me missing it, the fact Olmec's dead.
Okay, and then I thought we would also just provide a little bit of background on the Darksaber as a refresher as well. So
there is
like a perfect exchange in one of these episodes
exposition
between Kanan and Fen Rau, where Kanan says, "I didn't know Mandalorians developed a type of lightsaber," and Fen Rau says, "We didn't. This was one of a kind. Legend tells that it was created over 1,000 years ago by Tar Vizsla, the first Mandalorian ever inducted into the Jedi Order. After his passing, the Jedi kept the saber in the temple. That was until members of the House Vizsla snuck in and liberated it. They used the saber to unify the people and strike down those who would oppose them. At one time, they ruled all of Mandalore wielding this blade. The saber is an important symbol to that house and respected by other clans." That is a perfect bit of exposition, as you said, explains why it's so important.
I like the, like, dynamic illustrations, too, during that. And the fact he said liberated the lightsaber. Stole it.
So, just as a reminder, too, this is all also becoming important in The Mandalorian, where we saw Moff Gideon with it in the very last episode of season one, which, like, we hadn't watched Rebels at this point, so we were just like, okay. But definitely would look at it differently
cool
now.
Sword man.
And also obviously figured very heavily into season two, and we'll see through the course of these episodes of Rebels that the last anyone knew, Bo-Katan was in possession of the Darksaber, and then she obviously somehow lost it, and it was in the possession of Moff Gideon, and now Din Djarin has it, because Bo-Katan that insisted that it had to be won in combat,
even though Sabine
hands it to her in Rebels.
Maybe she feels like she has to win it this time because she lost it so easily last time.
Bo-Katan is having, like, really bad luck.
Yeah, agreed.
So let's get into the actual plot. So we're going to start off with Season 3, Episode 16, Trials of the Darksaber. And this is right after Sabine has recovered the Darksaber from the Night Sister's lair on Dathomir.
Wait, before we get into this, can we talk a little bit about Maul in that episode?
Sure.
Where, like, okay, so it's recovered on Dathomir because Maul's trying to figure out where Kenobi is, and he needs Ezra's information to do that. So he, like, convinces Ezra to cooperate with him. And just the part in that episode where, like, Ezra finally says, "No, I'm never going to be your apprentice," and Maul just goes, "That disappoints me." Like, this was a very rare instance of me appreciating Darth Maul, and yeah. So
I've come to appreciate him a lot more, and I feel like a big part of that is because he's just so dramatic.
But his voice really, oh man, oh, the way he talks, and like, oh, it was
driving me crazy. Look at how dramatically he had to die. Like, come on. I loved that episode. That was a great episode, Twin Sons. But like,
I was so surprised it happened. God, like, he finally died. I was just like, you're kidding. Did he just die? He's not dead. He can't possibly be dead. He's like, survived when people thought he was dead so many times. I'm still partially convinced he's alive.
But that's like how he wanted to die. Like, he had a death wish and he was like, I need to just die. Like, I need to be in the presence of Obi-Wan and then I'll just die.
Yeah. I was kind of distracted during that episode, and so I looked up and I was like, wait, what? So yes. Oh, and also for the Night Sisters, still so good. So good. We should read Dark Disciple.
Yes, I totally like. Should. Mm-hmm. All right. So Sabine has recovered it, but she basically doesn't want anything to do with it. And of course, there are people that do want her to do something with it, including Hera, who tells her that she has to ask her to wield it to get the Mandalorians to fight on the rebellion side. And then Kanan says that although they do have to ask, she doesn't have to do it. But yeah, she basically knows that, like, all these people are going to ask her to do it. And Kanan decides to try and train her to use it. And that was a little difficult for me.
Really?
Yeah.
I felt like Hera was being really hard on Kanan, actually.
I didn't quite feel that way. I feel like she was making very valid points. So Kanan decides to train her, but he's like, she doesn't know how to use the Force. I don't think I can train her. And Hera points out that, you know, Kanan wasn't giving Ezra sticks to train with. He was training with a lightsaber. And Hera, I think, just understands Sabine in a very specific way because she has so many issues with her own family. And so, like, she understands where Sabine is coming from there. And
but I feel like Kanan's points are also super valid, where he's just like, she's unbalanced. Like, she is so, like, she is not willing to engage more deeply with things. And so he doesn't feel comfortable giving her a weapon because he feels like since she's unbalanced, she's going to hurt herself.
Yeah, I don't know. That just kind of, like, just rubbed me the wrong way that he was so adamant that, like, she wasn't going to get it. He shouldn't even really be trying. Like, she wasn't going to commit to it, whereas Ezra immediately, like, really wanted it, and because she didn't immediately really want it, it wasn't going to be successful.
As I said that out loud, it did sound kind of paternalistic.
Yeah.
Paternalistic. Yes, although I was appreciative of the montage, like the training montage, where they're doing the poses, obviously, as a fencer. Like, I was like, oh, yeah. Not that those were what you would do in fencing.
Well, what I really appreciated was that actually, like, Ezra kind of stepped in and started training with her, and he was, like, a lot better at relating to her and, like, not being just so pessimistic about it. Like, I just liked seeing them train together. I thought it was nice.
I do too. And I feel like that is, I think it's fairly safe to say that Kanan's not a great teacher in general. he struggled with Ezra in part because he was holding back, as he says, but also, like, I don't know. He kind of reminded me of my mom, right? Where it's kind of like intuitive. And like, even though she's been a teacher, she kind of struggles to like articulate things because it just comes to her. And it, I had like overtones of that with Kanan's teaching where I'm just like, you need to explain this better because this might make sense to you, but you're omitting a bunch of stuff.
So also while she's training, Fen Rao gives her what I called gauntlets, but apparently they have a specific name, which is Vambraces.
Nice.
That are designed specifically to combat the abilities of the Jedi. So yes. It's like a bunch of different things, but it also includes a lasso for some reason.
Well, like Cad Bane, right? Except his was a wire. Same sort of principle.
And then Kanan is like just also very negative about this. And I'm sure this was meaningful to Sabine for Fen Rao to give this to her. And Kanan's like, well, that's not going to help you. The Jedi won the war against the Mandalorians and you don't need other weapons. You need training and discipline. And
yes, then, but at the same time, like she basically like gets these Vambraces and then just like uses them to defeat Ezra, which is fine. Like, you know, he does need to be taken down a peg. That's all good. But then she like immediately decides that like, oh, now that she has these, she can go for Kanan. And he just like defeats her soundly and points out that, yeah, that's when he's like, history lesson. The Jedi won that war because, yeah, the Vambraces are a useful tool. But I feel like the over-reliance that Sabine immediately demonstrates is, like, a valid concern for Kanan.
So Sabine gets really angry, which, like, again, I don't know why. I just find myself relating. That was after I said, like, I don't relate to Sabine. I don't know why I'm relating to her, specifically as it pertains to her training with the Darksaber. So Sabine is angry, and Ezra says, like, oh, well, they all mean well. And she's like, do they? And I'm like, exactly, do they?
I felt like
because they all have like reasons that they want her to be able to wield the Darksaber, and like I totally get that. Like, I don't think I would feel very happy, or I think I would feel the same in that situation.
Yeah, I feel like for me it's frustrating because Sabine knows, I mean, they're family. She knows they mean well. She knows this. But I think
that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Is that, like, they have become her family, and she feels like she can't go back to her biological family. And now these people that have become her family are treating her this way. That would be upsetting.
Yeah. But I do think it's, like, she's projecting her feelings about her biological family onto this family. Like, they do mean well, but she's getting reactive because this is evoking memories that she doesn't want to deal with and situations she doesn't want to deal with. But so, before we go back,
yeah, go ahead.
Continue. Ezra's so good in this scene. Like, he's so good. He says, like, he acknowledges her feelings. He says, like, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way, and then like the last thing he says is like, at least you have a family, which I just felt so bad for Ezra at that point. Like, and also like Sabine knows it, like, you know, she knows he's not wrong.
So speaking of family, Sabine believes that she can never go back to her parents on Mandalore, and this is where I was talking about the fact that Hera sympathizes because of all that she's gone through with her family. And she has another conversation with Kanan where she's basically like, you just need to let her train. You need to not hold back. She's already hurt. Her family will hurt her more than any sword.
I feel like that's very, very exaggerated, though. I'm like, if she... like, wields the Darksaber wrong, she could kill herself. Like,
but should they really be so concerned about somebody who, like, builds and plants bombs injuring herself?
Yeah, I do agree with that, because, like, it's weird because, you know, Sabine has gone through the academy. She is really disciplined. Like, this, like, rage quitting and then, like, getting all worked up, like, it is, like, it's her issues with her family that's, like, her flashpoint. And so it's just so interesting that, like, yeah, there's on both sides, there's just like this, you know, she's reacting in ways that are atypical for her, and they're reacting in ways that are atypical for them because, like, of the situation. So, yeah.
So, basically, after all of this, she's continuing to train with Kanan, and they have one kind of matchup where he is basically, like, baiting her into telling the truth and using her emotions about that to fight. And
getting her through those emotions.
Yeah.
In a very Mandalorian fashion, I feel.
Yes.
Right? I'm going to express myself with this weapon.
She, in the end of this episode, reveals that, you know, the reason that she can never go back is because she, in her time at the Imperial Academy, created a weapon that was used against Mandalore so that the Empire could control them. So it's called the Arc Pulse Generator, but it is nicknamed the Duchess.
I want to know the story behind that so badly. Like, later in one of the later episodes, Bo-Katan's just like, you named it after my sister. And she's like, it was a series of very poor decisions as a youth. And I'm just like, what led you to that one?
So once she found out that it was being used against Mandalore, she spoke out, and her family didn't back her because they wanted to survive under the Empire. And so she feels like she's, first of all, a traitor to Mandalore for creating that weapon in the first place, and just feels like her family never wants to see her again.
That entire exchange where she's just like, for my mother, for my father, for my brother, everything I did was for Mandalore. I just felt like that really exemplified Taya Sirkars. I'm sorry, Sirkars. I don't know how to say her last name. Vicky from The Good Place. Her range with that, like, that was really, it was so good. It was so good. And, like, then she worked through it. Like, she worked through her emotions, and she was finally able to defeat Kanan. And, you know, then she was able to, like, move on a little bit, like, move forward.
And she showed that she could master the Darksaber.
Mm-hmm.
So then it seems like people are starting to acknowledge her as the leader of the Mandalorians. So at the end of this episode, Fenn Rau kneels in front of her, and then Kanan and Ezra.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go into season 3, episode 16, Legacy of Mandalore, where they actually go to Mandalore to see Ursa Wren and try to convince her to follow Sabine. And then kind of, like, start a chain reaction for the other clans to follow her as well.
And this is what we were talking about, where it's just, like, they land, like, they're trying to make the approach. Sabine announces herself, and then they immediately, like, fire missiles, and they have to make an emergency crash landing that Sabine was not guaranteed to survive.
Yes. So, you know, Ursa is her mother, and, like, despite all of this, you would think that if your daughter came back, you would at least talk to her first, have a conversation, but no. And Ursa actually throws her in a cell and, like, eventually kind of comes around, although, as you said, she was willing initially to kill Sabine, and she's not at all happy that she's involved with Jedi or with the Rebellion.
There are so many layers of betrayal going on here. Like, these episodes made me very disillusioned in Mandalore and Mandalorians. Like, that's what my little, like, honor, quote unquote, at the beginning of the intro was about. Because, like, basically, I think I've been misjudging Mandalorians because, despite the fact there's a lot of hangups about honor, they are more than willing to betray you if that means they get what they want. They're ruthless. They're ruthless. And this is demonstrated very clearly. Yeah, like, family's important.
Maybe that's not the norm, though, because they are under the Empire right now. Like, they're basically occupied by the Empire, so.
But But even going back to Satine, right? You were talking about, like, Bo-Katan betraying her sister. You had the entire Death Watch thing. You had Pre Vizsla not showing any honor, like, multiple times, as we talked about in our episode about Satine and Obi-Wan. Like, it's just, like, you get to the point where you're just like, wait a minute, this is a lot of betrayal for a society that, like, supposedly is built on honor. And then, like, as we'll talk about more in, like, the episode where they go to, like, defeat the Duchess. But, like, I watched these episodes with Darth Brooks, and I was like, see, this is why, it's like, you know, Mandalorians wouldn't do this. And he's like, I'm pretty sure Candoris Ordo, who's one of the characters in KOTOR, would totally use that machine, hands down. Like, maybe not against his own people, but he would use it and keep it. So, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about Mandalorians now. And we didn't talk about, like, going back when Kanan was, like, discussing training her. He was like, she's so expressive, but so closed off, so Mandalorian. And I'm just like, yeah, man. So, Mandalorians.
Yeah. So Sabine also reunites with her brother Tristan, and he is eventually just, like, skipping over a lot of things. Eventually, who saves them? Because he betrays on Gar Saxon when Saxon is actually about to harm his family.
Betrayal.
Which, would Ursa do that? I'm not sure.
Good question.
Although I guess she does. Well, we'll get to that. So. Also, Sabine's father, as we mentioned, had been taken as a prisoner, so he's not around.
Basically, a hostage, really.
Yeah. So they're all being threatened eventually by Gar Saxon and his men, and Fenn Rau comes in and saves the day and returns the lightsabers that had been confiscated from Ezra and Kanan. And they all fight back, and then Sabine eventually battles Gar Saxon one-on-one. And she wins, but she refuses to kill him, per Mandalorian tradition.
And again, like, you know, they're fighting on the ice, and Kanan, like, moves in to help, and Ursa Wren's just like, this is not our tradition. And I'm just like, it feels like you're just kind of using that as an excuse. Like, in the situations where, like, I don't know, it just seems very inconstant. We're inconsistent, where it's just like, sometimes it's one-on-one combat and no one can help, and other times it's one-on-one combat, but you know what, buddies, let's get in there and fight. Like, and Kanan raises a point where it's just like, is that worth more than your daughter's life? And I'm like, yeah, is it?
Yeah. So she decides not to kill him and actually says, the Mandalorian way is not my way, and then starts to walk away. And she hears a shot being fired, and she thinks that it's Gar Saxon who's about to kill her, and it's actually Ursa shooting Gar Saxon.
Yeah.
So Gar Saxon dies, and then Fenn Rau has this little monologue about how Saxon is guilty of treason against the throne, collaboration with the enemy, and execution of his fellow protectors. He also says that Saxon's death will cause chaos on Mandalore. And then I'm interested to hear what you have to say about this. Ursa responds that Mandalore needs chaos in order to rebuild and find a worthy leader.
That makes no sense, but also, like, since when are Mandalorians scared of the Empire? Like, I'm just, I don't know what happened to Mandalore. I'm in favor of anything that gets them a worthy leader.
So, yeah, once this, again, like, Mandalore still doesn't want to get involved in anything. They hate that the Empire is, you know, ruling over Mandalore by proxy, but, like, they still are, like, don't want to get involved with this rebellion.
Which is so crazy to me, because, again, Mandalore is all about tradition and war and, like, proving yourself in battle, and, like, this screams battle, and they're like, no. Like, doesn't make any sense. Just doesn't make sense.
So then Sabine decides to stay on Mandalore to hopefully rescue her dad and also kind of help them out before she, like, becomes fully involved with the rebellion, even though they're apparently not going to as a society.
Yeah. I thought that was, I was sad that she decided to stay, but I understood why she did.
And well, then yeah, because we've discussed, like, she's just reconciled all of this, and her leaving Mandalore and then coming back and seeing her family again. So I get why she would want to focus on that for a little while.
Her mother trying to kill her, and then, you know, 40 minutes later, water under the bridge, that sort of thing. Right.
Trying to kill her, and then 40 minutes later, killing someone for her. Like, yeah.
What happens on Mandalore stays on Mandalore. I don't even know.
So now we're going to jump ahead a bit to the first episode of season 4. So all this time, Sabine has been on Mandalore and has not been appearing in Rebels. Mm-hmm. So this episode starts with Ezra, Sabine, and Fenn Rau going to rescue Sabine's father. So I guess, like, some time has passed. I don't know how long.
Yeah. They had intelligence that he was supposed to be at this location. Who knows how long the intelligence starts to gather.
So really all, or like a lot of my notes about this are just about how Ezra was given a jetpack and he was not excited about it.
I don't understand why he wasn't excited about it, because, I mean, later on he wields it quite well, but like, it's a jetpack. That'd be so cool.
No, I would also be very apprehensive about using a jetpack. Like, again, I feel like I would just injure myself severely.
Oh, yeah.
Like the first time I attempted to use it. So I completely understand, like, it's not familiar to him. I would prefer not to.
See, and I'm like, I would totally injure myself, but I would also be very excited to try. And especially if I could get some band braces and the helmet. Be very excited. Although, point, that, like, at one point they show, like, they're looking over at the prison, and they show the, like, visual of the inside of a Mandalorian helmet. It is so impractical. That, like, little, like, narrow eye band and then the narrow, like, face thing. I'm like, you can't see. So they should probably improve those helmets.
So we also see Sabine actually leading troops with the Darksaber, which is just awesome. We referenced earlier that, I guess, Ursa Wren, like, summoned Bo-Katan to help. And so she has a conversation.
Oh, I know why, though. It's because they storm this place and they defeat everything. And then her dad's not there, but Sabine is almost, like, injured. Like, she's, like, incapacitated, and then Bo-Katan shows up and saves the day, and then now Bo-Katan's involved, and that's why you have Bo-Katan right there.
Okay. So yes, Bo-Katan gets involved, and she and Sabine have a conversation where, like, Sabine is aware of what Bo-Katan has done for Mandalore in the past, I guess, even though questionable. And
agree.
Sabine just tries to give her the Darksaber, and she's like, no, I had my chance to rule and I failed. And then she also says, I'm not my sister. And if you listen to this podcast, you're aware of our thoughts on Satine as a ruler of Mandalore. So I just had to laugh at that statement a little bit.
It's true. I didn't even think about it that way. She says it like it's a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, Satine. You seem so cool, but so frustrating at the same time.
Extremely frustrating. Much prefer Bo-Katan, even though she has her shortcomings as well.
Agreed. Also, I think I texted you while I was watching these episodes and just said that Katie Sackhoff made me appreciate Katie Sackhoff. And her voice acting is very good in this. And I feel like I can no longer say I dislike her. I've transitioned beyond that point. So I'm not.
Thank you for redeeming yourself, Katie Sackhoff.
You've impressed me by your normal existence.
By this work that you did long before appearing in The Mandalorian.
So I'm not going to say I'm like a huge fan, but I don't begrudge her involvement in Star Wars now.
So Ursa then tells Sabine that they're moving her father to the capital to be publicly executed. So then they have to disrupt the Imperial convoy. They do. They save him. And then, unlike Ursa, he is actually happy to see her.
Yeah, although there is that pause where you're like, oh my gosh, being your family sucks. But no, then he says, you are my daughter. And then immediately starts.
Yeah, and then starts criticizing her art. But, yeah. You know, I guess that's just their family dynamics.
Yeah, I get that. I feel like my dad would totally do that to me, too. So Sabine, Ezra, Kanan, and Chopper, I think, are all rescuing Sabine's dad. And there's a cliff. And Ezra's like, wait, there's a cliff. And so he, Ezra gives Sabine's dad the jetpack, which I thought was funny. And it's just like, here, take it. He's like, what about you? And he's like, trust me, I'm better off without it. So Sabine's like, the convoy is going, or the transport is going over the cliff. Sabine's dad flies out with the jetpack. And then Ezra does this like Legolas-esque thing where he like jumps thousands of feet from one transport to another transport to another transport. They land. They call Sabine's mom. And it's just like, We've successfully rescued him. And she's like, excellent. The Saxon clan forces are falling back too. And then Sabine hears this like noise over the intercom. And it's not an intercom. The communication device that I can't think of. And she's like, run, run. And then there's silence. And so then they go to the battlefield, or the site of the battle between the Wren forces and the Saxon forces. And they just see these corpses of Mandalorians. And they touch them and it disintegrates. And Bo-Katan says, what happened to the survivors? The victors? Like, where is everybody? And I honestly thought that Sabine's brother and mother had died. Like, they were dead.
Yes. So that's what Sabine thinks as well. Yes. And she recognizes that it's her weapon, the Duchess, that has been used. And that's why the bodies are, like, essentially vaporized and only their armor is remaining.
Yep.
So that's how that episode ends, is that she thinks that her mother and brother have been killed by the weapon that she created.
Yeah. I was very emotionally invested at this point and was just like, oh my gosh, I can't, like, this is insane.
So the second part of Heroes of Mandalore opens with Sabine blaming herself for everything that had happened with the weapon. And obviously being very distraught. However, it turns out that her mother and brother are actually alive because they did hear her warning and they were able to get out of the way in time. Mm-hmm. So that is good for everyone.
Yeah. And then I think they start to flee because the Saxon troops come back. Possibly the ghost picks them up. And then these Saxon-wielding TIE fighters show up. Possibly. there's a space battle or an aerial battle.
Yes, because then also there's more jetpacks and
I love
Ezra
this,
is with Bo-Katan and he's like, what are we gonna do? We have no weapons. And she says, a Mandalorian with a jetpack is a weapon. And then Ezra is like, I don't want to be a Mandalorian. And I'm like, I feel you.
Yes. Exactly. It was just like the like petulance and I don't wanna, like, I also don't want to. But they both successfully destroy the TIE fighters. So Bo-Katan like throws a grenade into the cockpit of one, and Ezra just like hits the windshield of the other because he's still not very good with the jetpack. And then somehow manages to like launch one of the rockets, which just like cracks me up every single time. They kind of have to like hunch and like bend over, and then it's like, good fun for me.
So yeah, this is where like Thrawn has his moment talking about the Duchess as a weapon, and he's like explaining it to Saxon and how it's such a work of art because it turns a strength of the Mandalorians into a weakness. Because it's drawn specifically to Beskar, and it then vaporizes, like, whatever is inside it, which is the person. And at this point, Saxon has rebuilt the weapon, but he doesn't really know how to use it to its fullest potential, so Thrawn tells him that he needs Sabine.
You need the person. I can't do a proper Lars Mikkelsen impression, but it's very much like, you need the one who created this. I can't do it.
I don't know, like, that all just irks me, like, him being like, oh, but you don't understand, like, you don't truly understand the essence of this weapon.
He's so full of himself. I hate arrogance.
Do you, though?
Yeah, like, it's like the, it's the pretentious arrogance, right? It's pretentiousness. That's what really gets me. You can be cocky to a point, and you can be competent. You must be competent, but yeah.
And then I want to point out there's, like, this one Mandalorian captain who keeps being like, but how do you know that the Empire won't turn this weapon against us? And he's like, no.
I am the Empire.
Like, I have control over all of this. And then just, like, several times over the course of the episode, he's like, but how do you know? How do you know they're not going to turn it on us?
Yep. I feel like that's a great question to ask. Also, what is the Saxon's name? It's not Gar Saxon because he's dead. That was incidentally Ray Stevenson. And they're both, like, blonde and, like, kind of annoying looking. Oh, I forgot to mention Sarah Michelle, just periodic voice actors. Sarah Michelle Gellar is Seventh Sister, which I thought was, like, amazing. Ah, Tibber
Saxon. Tibber, Tiber.
It's probably Tiber. But Tibber sounds hilarious.
It sounds like Tigger.
Wonderful thing about Tibbers. Tibbers are wonderful things.
Also, a scene this episode where, like, Bo-Katan just completely flips out on Sabine for betraying Mandalore. And is just, like, screaming at her, like, how could you do this? This is a weapon of a coward. How could you betray Mandalore? What?
It's so inconsistent. Like, I don't know. Maybe betraying your sister would also be a cowardly act.
True. Yeah, I would like to know, like, what they consider to be, like, what exactly, like, they're defending, or what they consider to be what's right for Mandalore.
Yeah, because it seems to be, like, whatever they want to do at that particular moment. Like, Fenn Rao is like, I have to listen to the Empire, and I'm doing the right thing, and it's honorable, and it's just like, is it though? Like, yeah.
So eventually she kind of, like, changes her mind when Sabine explains to her, like, she was young, she was arrogant, she did it to see if she could, basically, but then she realized what was happening and she destroyed the weapon and the plans. Then there's also an interesting discussion between Sabine and Ezra about Beskar and how it's part of their identity and culture. And Ezra's like, well, why don't you just make your armor out of something else if this weapon exists and it's going to kill you? Like, just don't use Beskar anymore.
Oh my God, the look on everyone's face is just like heresy.
And they're just like, no, like, we can't just make our armor out of something else. Sabine tells him her armor is over 500 years old and she's reforged it, but, you know, it's like, it's very traditional and it's part of who they are. And then again, to, like, go back to the inconsistency, Bo-Katan replies, now it's going to make us dead.
Yeah.
So, again, just, like, kind of jumping around this episode, like, there are a bunch of other Mandalorians who, like, come for Sabine, essentially, and her family at this point actually does try to protect her.
Yay!
Sabine just tells them the truth that, yes, she did create the weapon, but, you know, now she needs to destroy it and convinces them to help her. And also Bo-Katan helps out in getting them to not attack Sabine and to be on her side. So, yes. I don't know. I like their interactions and their, like, getting to respect one another.
Yes. And especially, like, so after this point, they go to attack Tibber and the machine, because they're going to destroy the machine and whatever data they have on it. And Sabine and Bo-Katan kind of partner up, and it reminded me a lot of the last episode in The Mandalorian, where it was like Cara Dune, Fennec Shan, and then who am I missing? There was another lady there. Is it Bo-Katan? It's Bo-Katan. Who is that? I can't think of her name. When they partner up together, it just makes me want to, like, wish I could fight. So, yes.
Very cool. And then she also has a conversation, and by she, I mean Bo-Katan, is having a conversation with Fenrau about Sabine, and she tells him that Sabine has won her over, and that she reminds her of the best of us and what Mandalore can be, and that she can inspire action in others. So I think it is really interesting, too, how Sabine kind of, like, sets this all up, mm-hmm. and puts things into motion for Bo-Katan to kind of pick up on.
Yeah.
Although we don't get to see what that actually is. So again, we don't know like what went wrong between this and the Mandalorian, but I think it is really interesting how like it is Sabine that kind of gets her to that point.
Yeah. And again, emphasizing that Bo-Katan just has really bad luck.
Yeah.
Your life is hard.
Yes. So, as you said, Sabine and Bo-Katan do team up to destroy the Duchess, but as they're trying to deactivate it, they get knocked out by it. And then the captain, again, with Saxon, continues to be like, well, if we try to make this weapon stronger, then, like, why wouldn't the Empire use it against us?
See, these are the underrated heroes. It's this nameless captain and Melch, like the true heroes of the story.
Yeah, the Tipper is basically just like shut up, incapacitates him with the weapon.
Yeah, initially he's just like stand back, and then he's like, you know what, you're being incapacitated too.
So at this point, Sabine is awake again, and she agrees to activate the weapon.
After Tibber threatens her and says, like, I'm going to kill Bo-Katan. She's like, okay, I'll do it. And this is really where he should have taken Thrawn's words to heart.
Right. So she's just like, whatever, does whatever she's doing with the weapon. And then she's like, okay, it's at full power now, but please, like, I'm begging you, don't use it. And he's just like, whatever, and activates it. And it's revealed that Sabine changed it so that it would target stormtrooper armor, which, like, not sure how she would do that.
I don't know either.
But again, this is part of the conversation, too, where, like, she was talking with Fenrau, and I think he suggested that. And, like, they were like, no, we can't do that. Like, we just need to destroy it. So that happens, and then Saxon is incapacitated, and Sabine is about to kill him with the weapon. And
I feel like this is just like a massive lack of imagination on his part, right? Like, he doesn't understand how this weapon works. He threatens someone, he has no idea what she did, and then instead of like checking things out, he's like, ah, incapacitates himself.
Yeah. So I'm also like, there are many stormtroopers that are also incapacitated.
But it's not enough to kill them. It's just enough to teach them a lesson.
Right, exactly. They're just unconscious. And again, Sabine is about to like actually kill at least Tibber, if not other people. And Bo-Katan is like, no, you can't do that. That would be cowardly. And you would be doing that out of fear rather than honor.
Yeah, I just need them to outline their, like...
Right, their code.
Value statements.
Yeah.
Their code. Tell me, in these situations, how would you react?
In any case, Bo-Katan does convince Sabine to destroy the weapon.
And before we get to the next part, this is something that, like, is very common throughout Star Wars, right? Like, she incapacitates them, but doesn't kill them, but then just like leaves them in a position where they're like doomed to die. Like the ship just blows up and they're dead anyways. Like,
but she didn't kill them.
She didn't personally kill them.
Right. So she's not directly responsible for their death.
I feel like she is directly responsible for their death.
And like it's fine with Bo-Katan also, because Sabine didn't like directly kill them, but I think it was fine for them to be left to die.
Yeah, exactly. If they can't escape an exploding ship, that's really on them.
They don't have jetpacks, too bad for them.
Yep, exactly. It just reminded me of Firefly, where he was Mal was talking to Saffron, and he's just like, yeah, you just left him in a position where it was easy for them to die. Yeah, that's what they do. The entire ship blows up, including the weapon. Chopper erased the databases to eliminate all information about the weapon, and now the Mandalorians are safe, in theory.
Yeah. So after all of these events, all of the Mandalorians that are present basically start one by one for their clans, declaring that they are with Sabine. And then Sabine is like, no, 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 like, I am not the rightful ruler of Mandalore. And she, again, just gives the Darksaber to Bo-Katan. She doesn't protest at all. She takes it and says, I accept the sword for my sister, for my clan, and for all of Mandalore. And then that's the last we know of Bo-Katan until the Mandalorian.
Yeah. I have so many questions. But I'm optimistic that those questions may be answered as the Mandalorian transitions to Mandalore.
Right, because the next season has to be about Mandalore, because now we have Grogu off with Luke training, and Din has the Darksaber, and I think, like, we're going to get into... hopefully what has happened on Mandalore in the interim, because there was also a weird statement that someone made that they were like, oh, Mandalore, like, Mandalore was turned to glass. So what happened to Mandalore itself?
Also, I really hope there's not a romance. And, you know, as I say this, there's going to be a romance between Din and Bo-Katan. I hope there's not.
I don't want that.
Me either.
So Bo-Katan has really bad luck and also doesn't age.
Yeah, although I like, seeing her face in this made me very aware that there was, like, some change in animation, for sure. Because she does look subtly different. Her nose seems longer.
Any overall thoughts on these episodes or on Sabine and Bo-Katan?
I'm very excited for Sabine to find Ezra. And I look forward to Bo-Katan in a platonic relationship. Also, if Kevin McKidd wants to show up as Fenn Rau, I would be there for that.
I would also be on board with that because, as I said, I like Kevin McKidd. I just absolutely hate his character in Grey's Anatomy. And I would welcome seeing him in another role.
Yes, and actually Gina Torres, too. Like, I would happily see her in a live-action series by Disney because she's amazing.
Now that I've complained about Grey's Anatomy throughout this entire episode... I think that's it for this episode.
This is the Rogue One Grey's Anatomy episode. Also some Mandalore.
I blame it all on Kevin McKidd. Although, again, I like Kevin McKidd.
It's all right. If I find, like, for the image on our website that no one visits, I'll find a very... flattering image of Kevin McKidd. That sounds terrible. Good. I will not do
Don't
that.
Don't find one from Grey's Anatomy.
Yes, exactly. I'm thinking something from Rome or... No, it's going to be Kingdom of Heaven.
Our intro and outro music is by Lobo Loco, and our segment break music is by Poddington Bear. You can find us on our website at StarWarsSleepover.com. We're on Twitter at SW Sleepover and on Instagram at Star Wars Sleepover. And if you want to check me out on Twitter, I am at Stelle Lontane, StelleLontane. Please also consider subscribing, rating, and reviewing wherever you listen to podcasts, because that does help us out and help other people find us if they'd like to listen. We would also love feedback from our listeners about anything you've heard or about upcoming topics that you'd like us to cover. In the meantime, we will be back in 2 weeks to talk about Dr. Aphra. Thanks for listening.
And may the Force be with you.